Okay, hello and welcome to our INE office hours call for the month of February 2016. Sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. These are our calls where it's just open Q&A, whatever things you need to ask questions about, whether it's specific questions about a client, about one of their labs, about a particular course, whichever course you're in. These are open to people in three of our different courses, the CMDS, which is our digestive system, IRSPT, which is the insulin resistance, and then NEPT, which is our full-blown nutritional endocrinology practitioner training. So there's could be a variety of calls across all different subject matter, and you're open to ask whatever questions you have related to that, and especially love questions related to clinical care. There's usually no screen share on these unless somebody uploads a lab to me and I try to share it, in which case we go to join.me to do that. I also open the join.me because it has an awesome chat, and yes, it's still disabled. Instantel Seminar disabled their chat, so no questions there. I will, and the way I handle these calls is I first check on any questions that have been submitted in advance on the website, and then if there's none there, then I go to, you know, open the lines and then Q&A, whoever types in. For those of you who are in NEPT, when you go to, every week we send you out a newsletter on Sunday. There's important information in there. We used to list every call that was happening during the week, and it got very cumbersome, and those messages got long, and we had recordings. So instead, what we do is we put a link to the calls for that week. So all you have to do is log into the membership site, then click the link in that email, and that'll give you access to the schedule. And we have them organized by the week and by the month and then by the types of calls. So you can kind of get the big picture overview and then drill down. What I'm starting to do in NEPT each week is I'm going to just kind of any calls that are outside of the regular coaching and Q&A calls, I will put in there with the Instant Teleseminar link, so it makes it a little bit easier for you to see that. But we generally don't, just because we're not trying not to repeat things in lots of different places. But we do give you a link to that page. So generally, there's not a screen share. There's no slides presented during these. It's just pure open office hours. Ask whatever you want and share whatever you want to share with me and with your fellow students. So with all that said, if you have a question and you're on the web, go ahead to the Q&A part and then just type your question in. The other way you could do it is on the chat that's on, nobody's on there yet, but a bunch of people are on the line though. Yeah, and so you can just type it into the chat over there, or you can type it in to the Q&A over here. So who wants to start us off with a question? So Lynn says, what's my approach to treating gout? So that's a great question, Lynn, and I'm going to start that. It's a great leading question, too. I'm going to start that with, I don't have an approach to treating anything because I don't treat diseases. What I do and what I teach you guys to do is to be looking at imbalances. So looking for functional imbalances. So a person is not a disease, and they may have a label that they've been given by medicine, and that's fine, but we don't necessarily use those labels other than to kind of know what those syndromes mean, what kind of processes are going on, and what kind of imbalances would go on. So I don't treat diseases, I treat people. So it depends on the person. So if I have someone, the typical pattern for someone with gout is usually a high-stressed male, you know, executive type is what I have in mind, but a high-stressed male, overweight, leading the good life, right? Eating a lot of red meat, red wine, and lots of heavy, fatty foods. And they tend to develop gout, which is the accumulation of uric acid crystals in a joint. Generally, the joint that's most affected or first affected by gout or is first noticed when somebody has gout is the big toe. So they may have a big, swollen, red, big toe. They may have bumps on it, which would be those gouty accumulations. And uric acid is a crystalline-type substance, can also cause kidney stones. So there is not I don't know statistically like the numbers of the percentage of people with gout that have kidney stones and vice versa, but I do know that the same mechanism is involved, although kidney stones are oftentimes oxalate crystals, which is a different kind of metabolic waste product. So how would I treat someone with gout? I would treat someone with gout the same way I would treat anybody. To start is I would take a complete history and find out what are the underlying factors that might contribute to them having an accumulation of uric acid in their blood that would then deposit into their toe. What kind of lifestyle do they have? What kind of diet do they have that might predispose? So that's the first thing. And then I would look at what are those habits that are contributing and help them to remove those. So first of all, getting people off of the high meat diet and put them on more of a lower purine diet. So gout would be, legumes can contribute to it as well. So helping them to reduce their protein intake would be a good start. Getting them on a lot of greens, getting them on a lot of anti-inflammatory type foods, making sure that their essential fats are in order. I would certainly test their blood. I would check for deficiencies of B6 and magnesium, and that wouldn't be in the blood. I would just check for deficiencies based on symptoms or based on surveys, which in NEPT we have like a 6-page document that lists all the nutrients, and it's just a summary sheet. It's not everything, but it's kind of the highlights of what kind of presentations you might see if someone has a deficiency. So I'd be looking for what are they deficient in. I'd have them do my online survey like that. But B6 and magnesium are very commonly reduced in gout, and an easy solution is to make sure they're getting a good source of those. Typically, people who get gout are not eating a diet that's plant-based and full of great vegetables and whole grains. They're usually eating, like I said, they're leading the good life with the red meat, red wine, lots of fatty and inflammatory foods, and they're under a lot of stress. So I would be working at reducing the stress. I would be looking at whatever the causes are in that particular person. And it may be different from person to person, but in general, we're looking at reducing the purines in the diet, getting rid of the alcohol, getting them on a really good plant-strong diet with lots of good antioxidant-rich vegetables, making sure they're on the B6. Cherry juice is often used as a quote-unquote treatment for gout, which can help. Bitter cherry or sour cherry, one of those two, one kind of cherry. It's not the sweet cherries, but that extract has been shown to be anti-inflammatory and help with symptoms of gout. So, and then there's other things as well. So it's you treat the person, not the disease. So, I hope that answers your question. And that I'll answer that for lots of things, but there's certainly certain directions you're going to go in. I would always look for dysbiosis in the gut, leaky gut, because that can be something that's causing an issue, especially in any kind of inflammatory thing. And like I said, the fats are critical, so getting them off of all the processed fats and hydrogenated fats and omega-6 fats and getting them to move more towards a higher omega-3 rich diet. If anybody has anything to add, if anybody has worked with anybody with gout and wants to add a few things that I might have not mentioned, go ahead and mention it in the chat. And I don't see anything in the chat right now. So, yeah, tart cherries, not bitter cherries. Tart cherries, thank you. All right. Yes, okay. Let me refresh and see. Measuring minerals in the blood, do you prefer RBC or whole blood? Does it vary based on the mineral? And yeah, it does. Like some of them are better in white blood cells. Some of them are better in red blood cells. I certainly don't think serum. So you always want to look at the cells, the cellular level. I also, you know, for minerals, I like functional tests. So, you know, I think a standard blood chem, you can see things like, hints or signs that they might have low zinc or magnesium, molybdenum, things like that. You can do an essential elements from doctor's data. They do the toxic and essentials. Those are not always that accurate, and hair is another way, but you have to know what you're doing when you look at hair. So I think it just varies based on the mineral. Good question. Lynn says, thank you. Very helpful. Super. Jamie said, I would also consider nightshades, especially tomatoes, for high uric acid. Yeah, so that's a good point, because a lot of folks, nightshades can aggravate the solanine, and the nightshades can aggravate joints. So you certainly want to. Anytime I have anybody with any kind of joint kind of inflammation, an arthritic condition of any kind, I would be looking at a nightshade elimination, at least temporarily, and then a provocation to see if that is an issue. Let's see. Some people with the nightshades are sensitive to the higher levels and the concentration, especially things like tomatoes, potatoes, eggplant tend to be highly concentrated, where things like the peppers, like cayenne, there's very little that you use. So unless somebody has a super, super sensitivity to it, they can often get away with using small amounts in things like cayenne, because the capsaicin can really be helpful in inflammatory conditions. So it's a matter of just finding what that right combination is for everybody. Let's see. Good. Let's see if I have any hands up, and let me look over here. Yeah, too much nucleic acid. That's what I was talking about earlier. The purines in the blood can raise uric acid. Sure, absolutely. Microalgae, Lynn is recommending as well. That's a good one. And that's, you know, covers that whole, when I think about that, you know, put them on a real good plant strong, green vegetable, vegetable strong, not necessarily plant strong, but vegetable strong diet and from the sea and from the land. So I always include things like algae and seaweed and things like that. And always to somebody's tolerance, right? If they have other conditions going on, they may not be able to tolerate, you know, sulfur foods, or they may not be able to tolerate things. I would certainly look at decreasing oxalates with somebody in gout, because there's such a cross pollination, if you will. So, any questions on the phone? Go ahead and raise your hand with a star 2, and that'll raise your hand, and that'll allow you to either share something that you'd like to share or ask a particular question that may have come up for you. And oftentimes when I answer some people's questions, people get questions based on those questions. So I don't see anybody else. You guys are quiet today. What can we talk about? All right. So Valerie. Hi, Valerie.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I do have a question. It's kind of a broad-based question about thyroid medication.
Mm-hmm.
I know when I first started taking it, they were saying to wait an hour before eating, and that this was years ago, and then they started saying it interacted with other minerals and things like calcium and stuff, so you were supposed to space it. And someone on a call last week was talking about taking it in the middle of the night because they needed 3 hours on either side.
That's the first time I'd heard of that.
Yeah, me too. But it got me thinking about, I'd like to get some clarification on, I mean, currently I'm on Westroid, and I wait a half an hour before I eat.
Mm-hmm.
But I still have a lot of questions about that, and about what kinds of other medications do I need to delay, because I take some of my others right after that. And then how does lemon water fit into that? And, you know, just a lot of things.
Yeah, we all have those questions because there is so much controversy, and, you know, from one endocrinologist to the other, one practitioner to another, some of them say that it's more important with Synthroid than it is with Armour and the naturals like the Westroid, that you don't have to wait as long. I've had people been told that there's no problem, they don't have to wait at all. Usually that's with the Westroid or Armour. I think the answer is we just don't know. I think the 3 hours is excessive. I've never heard that before, but there may be some particular situation in that person's life and what the doctor was talking to her about. I mean, 3 hours on either side, that like when do you do that? Except for the middle of the night, right? You have to.
That sounded more to me like when you would take your supplements. I have heard things like that. like waiting 3 hours before you take a calcium supplement or have dairy or something like that.
Yeah, and there are particular things that might be more apt to interfere. And I know there are very specific things and nutrient interactions that go on. I just got a book. It's called The Micronutrient. I'm hoping it has the answers in there because they claim it does. They talk about all the nutrient, the research on which nutrients go best with that research and whatever. And they put out a supplement that I've been trying that has it has two different packets. You do your morning and you do your evening, and they recommend you don't take them with food and you don't take any other nutrients around it so they don't interfere. And that's for ideal doses. So here's the thing with nutrients and with foods. I mean, foods are packages. Nature put a lot of different nutrients in foods. So if you're eating like food levels of things, I don't think you gotta drive yourself crazy and decide, well, I can't eat this with that and that with the other thing. Certainly, vitamin C-rich foods enhance iron absorption, and eating grains when you're taking your minerals can interfere because of the phytates and all kinds of things like that. But getting back to thyroid medication, I've heard it all over the map, and I've done research, I've looked at studies, and I haven't been able to find any concrete, consistent answers other than, you know, wait half an hour to, usually an hour is what people are told. Wait an hour, take your thyroid first thing in the morning and wait an hour before you take anything else. As far as lemon water, well, if there's a specific issue with taking vitamin C with thyroid medication, which it could be because vitamin C and iodine is not good together, but the iodine in the thyroid medication is already bound to the thyroid. So, I don't think there's any clear cut. I don't think you're going to get clear cut answers other than what does your doctor say? Do it and just go from there. I wish I had more answers for you.
Okay, that's fair. Thank you very much.
I've tried to find, really have, because I've worked with people who say, well, I can't do this and I can't do that. And the doctor said this and I'm trying to find out why. And I'm like, find out, ask the doctor if they think lemon water would be okay. And then some of them will say, oh, yeah, sure. And others say, oh, but I don't know. It's because they don't know either. I don't think we really know. So I think you can also, in general, when you're not sure about things like that, is check it out, right? If you were to be able to do a thyroid test, say once a month, and say you did a month where you did a half an hour and then you took everything and you tested your levels and then you did nothing else really different the next month, but you waited an hour or you ate them all together and you tested your thyroid levels. And if you see a difference, then maybe there's something there to it. But again, I mean, I can open that up. And when we do our thyroid module in NEPT, I'll be revamping and I'm always looking for the latest. So that's something I'll make a point of really searching out to see if I can find any consistencies. If anybody's out there that has any studies that, you know, can show consistently from one to the next, you can't just find a study and say, oh, this study says this. Well, yeah, but there's five other studies that say something different. And it also, I think it depends on the person. It depends on the stress levels. I mean, so many things can play in. That might be a good question to ask on next week on the 10th. So just a heads up, you guys, next week on the 10th, we have Dr. Wilson of the Wilson's Temperature Syndrome. He's going to come in and speak to us in an advanced clinical resource talk. And that might be a really good question to broach with him. He says with T3, there's no reason to wait. He doesn't have people wait at all when they're taking the T3 therapy that he recommends. So he may have a sense of what research is out there concerning Armour versus Westroyd versus Synthroid.
Okay.
Yeah, it's going to be a great one. And if you're on any medication or you're working with people, family members or clients that are on thyroid medication, please, or have been diagnosed in any way with thyroid, please come to that call next week. That's for our NEPT members. It's with Dr. Dennis Wilson, and he's a thyroid guru. He writes books and the whole bit. So. Okay.
That's great, because I have lots of questions about thyroid. I've been working on leaky gut. I had severe leaky gut, so I've been working on that the past 7 months. And I know that I'm absorbing things better because my vitamin D level went, without changing what I was taking, it went from in the 60s to the 90s.
Oh, that's great.
So
that's a good sign.
I've cut back on my thyroid. I was taking three of the, I don't know the size, but three of the larger ones. every morning, so I've cut back to two.
Super.
So I'm going to go at that level for a little while and then get the test run again.
Well, two resources for you now, if you want to dig in more with thyroid, is you've got access to the Thyroid Revive and Thrive program. You're in Mastery, right?
Yes.
So you have access to the Thyroid Revive and Thrive program. If you don't, let us know, because we'll let you know. And so what that means is when you go into any PT, on the right-hand side, you'll see menus of what you have, and one of it says Vibrant Living Members Website. And click there, and you should see on the right side, you should see your thyroid. So study the materials there. And then you also have access to the Shine Library. So you have access to all of our Shine presentations so far. We've had three of them. So you have access to the videos. The second one was on the HPAT axis, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal thyroid axis. So there's a lot of thyroid information in there as well.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay. And you also have access, I believe, to the library of our calls, the Q&A calls that we've done. Unfortunately, because the Q&A calls are just like all over the map, there's lots of different questions asked. We don't have any indexes, but I would say that a lot of the Q&A calls, especially all of them. I was going to say the first year of them, but all of those Q&A calls, inevitably thyroid comes up. So that's a great way to learn as well.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, we try not to let you just be like, here's the fire hose, and suddenly we're introducing a topic called thyroid, and we're going to teach you everything you know. You're getting exposure to it. And then when we do our thyroid module, we'll be going into a lot more depth. And when we open up, I don't know if it's open yet, but I think it should be open soon to you, is the blood testing. So go through the modules in the order that we release them. And then when you get to the blood testing one, there's a whole section in there on thyroid as well.
Great.
Okay.
Wonderful. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. So, Michelle. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Rita Marie. How are you?
I'm wonderful today. Thank you. How are you?
Good. I'm doing good. I don't know if this is the right call to ask this on, but I'm going to throw it out there, and then you can tell me if it'd be more appropriate to do in another way. I was looking over my test results for like the 205 test results.
Uh-huh.
And which I was looking, I mean, I looked at the adrenal ones, and I feel like I pretty much understand that for the most part. The second part of that test was on like the female hormones.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if you remember, but I'm taking like that Desbuecan product.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Progon product.
Progon. Mm-hmm.
To increase my progesterone levels. And I got my BioHealth test back from November, and my saliva progesterone level is like 2,547, which mm-hmm. it looks like the range for premenopausal should be 50 to 400,
yep.
which just seems like super, super high then.
Yep.
So what –
So
I
let me tell
I'm
you, first of all, don't be concerned about that, because it's
okay.
just saying that what you're taking is getting in there. It will reflect a much higher level, and a lot of the labs will even list that. They'll say premenopause, postmenopause, and then it'll say on supplementation or with
okay.
supplementation, and then the range. And the range is usually in that range of 1,000 to 2,000 or 2,500. So, it might be that you're taking a little more than you need. That's not a functional test. I would also be looking at what's that ratio and symptomatology, right? The better test for all of that stuff is your Dutch test or your 24-hour urine steroid test to see all the metabolites. But at this point, that's saying – great, whatever you're taking is getting in there, and it is on the higher end, and you could probably decrease your dose, but do it cautiously, because if it's controlling symptoms, if it's controlling that, the pain and the bleeding that you were getting, then certainly stay at whatever level it takes
okay.
to do that. You may need that super physiologic dose.
And then can you speak a little bit about like the salivary estriol and the salivary estriol. I mean, just generally kind of explain, like, what, I know they're both parts of the estrogen, but I was just curious as to why they, like, break those down to look at both of those. And
oh, yeah, that's a good question, because it's useless to just look at total estrogen. I mean, you have to look at, you can't just say estrogen. You have to look
right.
at the pieces. And so the best way to do it is actually to get all three, and then you, then you're able to do a ratio. And there's something
called
the
estrogen quotient. You mean like the all three
is? E1,
like
E2, E3. Estriol, estrone, and estradiol.
Okay, so
okay.
This test did the estradiol, the estriol, but not the other one.
Not the estrone. So I would add that only for the purposes of being able to do my estrogen quotient. And the estrogen quotient helps you to determine risk factors for breast cancer, indirectly iodine status, because if that ratio is off, if it's too low, it means that you likely don't have enough iodine to support that pathway. And we will go into all these pathways in grueling detail as we go through. And there's periodically places we'll pull them up and show them. And when we do, if anybody submits any of those cases, as we do start to do more case studies or lab calls, and I can pull some of those up. But we'll go through those in grueling detail, and you'll totally understand. They all have different purposes. Some of them are more proliferative, meaning they're going to put you higher risk for breast cancer type things. And then the estriol, which is the protective one, that one you want in the highest quantities, because that one's the protective one.
Okay.
Now
well,
that's
like
why
the,
they measure it. Yeah.
Okay. I was just curious about that, because I know, like, a year ago when I had my female hormones tested, my estrogen levels and my progesterone levels were both really low, but they said that the test indicated that I was estrogen dominant, but now it looks like my progesterone levels are way high because I've been using the Progon.
Right. And you're better off being progesterone dominant than estrogen dominant. To an extent,
right.
Like some people in excess progesterone can end up getting some depression. So you just watch that, right?
Okay.
And so you can play with your Progon dose and just see how you feel. I wouldn't dramatically drop it, but maybe drop it a little bit. And if you can take a little bit less and still maintain the improvement that you were getting with it, great. But I wouldn't go fast with it. I would go very slowly. And if ever you are helping people and putting somebody or yourself on progesterone and they get really depressed, that is a sign that they've got too much progesterone. When we look at PMS, one of the most rare types of PMS is PMSD, which is a PMS with depression. Most people have the irritability and the crankiness and the cravings. But some people have the depression, and that's oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes progesterone becomes dominant, and that can cause people to become depressed. And
so is that like what happens when women have like postpartum depression? Is it that their progesterone levels are higher? Is that what causes that, or is that totally kind of a different thing?
I think that's different, and we'd have to look at that.
Okay.
That the postpartum depression often comes because and a lot of times it's a woman whose liver isn't working effectively to break down the metabolized hormones. It's a huge flood of hormones that suddenly is like has to be gotten rid of because baby isn't there to need them anymore. And so you have to have really good detox mechanisms in place and really good estrogen pathways in the liver. And a lot of people have genetic imbalances. They have certain SNPs that slow those things down. And so sometimes women need more help with that, maybe more cruciferous or DIM or other things like that, and some of the nutrients that the liver needs to support that. So there's a lot that goes into that, the postpartum, and I don't think anybody's really identified it as being a single particular thing, but it's really has to do with the inability of the body to break down these huge quantities of hormones that are in the body.
Okay.
And it could be related to that, but I don't know for sure. Yeah.
Now, as far as like in my case with the higher levels of progesterone, because I'm supplementing. Now, I was on that call that you did with Dr. Anna Kabeka,
mm-hmm.
and she actually recommended doing like her product has like pregnenolone and progesterone in a cream form.
Mm-hmm.
She thought that might really help me with like my back pain, because I tend to get this
you know, I used to have the back pain all the time, and now it's sort of intermittent, but it seems like the week before I start my period, I get more extreme back pain. And she kind of had recommended trying that product in addition to doing the Bezwecan. Now with what do you think as
with
far
your
as
levels
my
that
levels
high,
like would
you
not
want to back off? I would say I would probably wean down, but you could certainly try it. It has the pregnenolone. I would have to look at
right.
what the doses are. You want to look to see. It might be mostly pregnenolone with a little progesterone, but if it's mostly
okay.
progesterone with a little pregnenolone, when you get the pregnenolone in their picture, then you you can – it's a better precursor, although progesterone is a pretty darn good precursor for the rest of them as well. I think this
okay.
is the conversion downstream because progesterone is in the same line of conversion down to cortisol. And so if you're in an adrenal fatigue and you take the extra progesterone, you want to be able to facilitate it moving down.
Right.
If it doesn't, there could
be some – that's definitely my situation because of
yep.
the cortisol – well, my cortisol levels are really low.
Yep.
So
and
it's
I don't remember
like
what she said, like why she said that. I remember her saying it
as
on the call.
As far as wanting to do both of them?
Why she thought both of them together.
Yeah, I don't really remember that either. I just know she had talked about that. And then when I was looking at these tests, I'm like, well, holy crap. I don't think I need to take more progesterone if this level is so high. I mean, my first thought was, is this really safe for it to be this high? But what you explained makes
yeah.
more sense to me. And I know
yeah.
at one time we had talked about eventually maybe doing the Dutch test.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, maybe like, I know I'm going to do like, I think I'm on the schedule maybe for like the next NEPT case study call. So I will bring all this to that and then maybe we will, maybe we'll be able to look at all of all those levels. And I just recently got like my thyroid checked and haven't gotten the results back from that. So,
okay. So that'll be a
that
good thing
stuff to play with. Yeah.
Yeah,
I would just had that question. On that. And then I had another question. If your DHEA, like your total cortisol sum is higher, like within the range, but on the low side, and your DHEA level, like the average DHE level, is extremely low, what stage of adrenal? I mean, that is like some sort of adrenal issue, correct?
For sure. And so if you're saying that the cortisol sum is on the lower end of the normal, but the DHEA is low, that's a stage two, what we consider a stage two. Stage two is when the cortisol is normal, but it either has
– it can be low.
Phasic. It can be phasic where it's totally out of phase or it's on the low end of normal or even if it's dead center normal or even high normal, but that DHEA is low. What I look at it is if your cortisol sum is at the high end of normal but it's in the normal range and your DHEA is low, I'm saying that that's a stage two, that you're newly down into stage two from stage one. And if it's more towards the lower end, I'm thinking you're closer to dropping into a stage three.
Because, I mean, the cortisol sum's 29, and then the DHEA average is 0.52.
Oy, yeah.
So the DHEA is definitely under the norm, and then the cortisol sum is 29. And her labs indicated that, her morning cortisol is on close to the high end of the range with
right.
a 23, but the rest of her levels throughout the day are below
yeah.
the norm.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of throwing, like, I kind
yep.
of feel like that's throwing that off with a cortisol sum of 29. It's like, well, it is, the average is 29, but realistically her morning cortisol is the only one that
exactly.
is
and
high. Exactly.
And you just brought something up that's super important that a lot of new functional practitioners don't take into account. They get the thing from the lab, everything says normal, and then that's what they tell people, it's not your adrenals. They're not looking at the ratios between them. They're not looking at the shape of the curve. the shape of the curve should be the same. If you've got a high here and a low there, it averages out, but who cares, right? A tall person and a short person average out to an average sized person. That doesn't mean that if you're an average sized person, there's, you know, there's something, anyway, that probably wasn't a good analogy, but
it's not like
I mean.
Functionally optimal.
It's not functionally optimal to take, you know, it's a big and a small and average it out. Averages don't mean anything, which is why so much of the way that conventional medicine does their blood analysis and comes up with those normal ranges is so screwy, because it has to do with, well, yeah, if this is at the high end of the range and this is at the low end of the range, there's a problem. So we have to look at ratios. And the same thing with thyroid, right? A lot of them just go, your thyroid, yeah, it's in normal range. Your TSH is normal. But then when you lay it out, I don't know if you remember this when we did thyroid. I don't know if you did that with us last summer.
I haven't done thyroid stuff.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, when we did the thyroid, we have this chart that Dr. Rind came up with. And I really like this chart because you can plot your TSH, T4, T3 on this graph. And even though they might all of them might show up as normal, if they're not in a straight line, then there's some problems. There's either an interconversion problem or an overstimulation or pituitary or whatever problem. So you're looking not at just absolute numbers. People aren't numbers, right? You can't just say, oh yeah, you're a number. But it's, you have to look at the whole picture. So when we did Sequoia's case the other day, it showed her TSH as 0.01 or something or less than that, which is super, super low. Now, a lot of doctors say, oh, that's fine, because when they put people on medication, they figure it's fine. She's not on medication. Now, if you look at that and you look at her T3 and T4 being normal, you might say, oh, she's fine. But no, that TSH shouldn't be that low. The pituitary is like sleeping on the job and the thyroid is still performing. So something's going on here. So you can't just look at a single number, and you can't just look at a range. You have to look at the ratios between the ranges.
Right.
Yep.
So like on the adrenal test, when I get the total sum, the DHEA average, and then the next line on the test is like the cortisol DHEA ratio.
Yeah, it's probably through the roof.
Yeah, so that's the only reason that's through the roof is because of those averages. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Because like the reference range is 5.0 to 6.0. Her level is like a 55.8.
Right, because she's got a high cortisol or high normal cortisol and a super, super low DHEA. Yep. And that's a more sophisticated way to look.
So in an instance like this, when her morning cortisol was like almost at the highest end. I mean, she's just under it. It's 23.2 and the high range is 24. But the rest of them are kind of almost bottomed out here. But her sum is within the normal range. What would be the cause of something like that? Would that be something that has to do with sleep patterns? Or how would you go about, like, ferreting that out to figure out, like, why is
it
high at
so
some
high
point in the morning
low
and then so
point?
Dropped out? Yeah,
it's
just curious
a pattern
if,
of
if
adrenal.
You notice that by working with people,
like
a lot of people, because I don't have that knowledge. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I would look at it. I would say she's fatigued. The DHEA is low. She's got adrenal fatigue. What is causing that to be high in the morning? Is I would say, well, what's going on during the night? Is she sleeping fitfully? Is she having nightmares? Did she have a history of sexual abuse or trauma or burglarization or, you know, family fights in the middle of the night, which caused her to be stressed during the night, which caused her cortisol levels to go up, which caused her to break down muscle tissue to create new blood sugar. So there's a problem there. So there's a lot of things that would cause it. I would be looking at, is she sleeping well? Does she fall asleep okay, which she probably does with it that low, but does she then wake up in the middle of the night? Is it starting to come up in the middle of the night? And what are some of those other things? Does she have parasites? Is she eating late at night? There's so many things that could cause that cortisol to be up in the morning.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, that's very interesting. Could that also be like partly due to, like, if she's eating late at night? I don't think she does, but you know, that would like affect her blood sugar.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
That could
yeah.
boost up her cortisol in
yeah.
the night.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't
yeah.
think it's that. I think it's more stress and some of the other things that you mentioned. But
yeah.
it'll be really yeah. interesting. She's one of the she's one of the case studies I'm submitting for Saturday's call.
Okay.
So I'm really, really curious as to, I was just looking at that and comparing it to my own, like to kind of just see where, like when her numbers were so high on certain things, it's like, I got to look mine up and see what it says about mine. And then I went back to the CAFE program, like the description of what each thing means. And it's like, okay, I wasn't sure if she was stage two or stage three because of such a low DHEA, and then the cortisol sum was, it wasn't on like the high end. So
yep.
Cortisol
sum
okay.
defines which stage you're suspicious of. And again, you know, stages are relative. We can have like seven stages. Some systems define seven stages, right? So there's,
yeah.
there's, you know, somebody who's at the bottom of the barrel, stage three, is going to feel a lot different than somebody who's at the higher end. So, you know, do you call it fatigue, failure? You can actually break each of those different stages into three stages.
Right,
and people
right.
are going to feel differently. It's just a matter, again, I go
just
back to
just depends on, like, what
beginning.
End of the range they are for that
yeah.
stage.
Yeah.
Okay.
We use the numbers, we use the classification system just so that we can kind of tell people where they are and label it and describe it. But there's, you know, each individual is individual. So you can't just say everybody with stage one has these particular characteristics in response to these particular things versus two or three. There's some general things like cautions if you are going to do bioidentical hormone replacement of pregnenolone and DHEA with someone. You certainly don't want to give someone in a stage one a lot of pregnenolone. May need some, but if you give them too much, they're just going to divert it down to more cortisol and raise their cortisol
right.
more. If you give somebody who's in a stage three too much DHEA or even sometimes any DHEA at all, even though they show that they need it, that can it can thwart the cortisol. So you've got to, it's just really being careful, which is why I like to work with herbs and foods and lifestyle first, but sometimes
right.
people just, that you just got to get them out of the situation they're in.
Right. Well, this will be really good for this person too, just because she doesn't do well with a lot of drugs or even supplement type things. She seems to work better with foods and things
right.
like that. Anyway, I'm excited to be on the call on Saturday to really go over this with you.
Wonderful.
For her case. I have one thing that I guess I was going to comment on was I saw that information that you posted for the Sharla Jacobs stuff.
Huh?
And her call, her live call is on Saturday too. It's like,
oh, I
dang.
Know. I saw that too. She's going to do,
like,
I have inside scoop. She's going to do two more after that. So don't worry about it. She's going
to
do two more live
so
calls.
I'll be able to
so
catch
if you signed
it
up for
time.
It and you didn't make
okay.
it, she'll tell you. She just won't announce
I'm like,
it.
God, I have to be on Saturday's call for this, you know.
No,
so,
she's going
to
have
well, that's
no. She'll announce
have
the
have
other two,
about.
But she's going
to
have two more
okay.
after that, so don't worry about it.
Awesome, awesome.
All
well,
right.
that was my main question on, well, my two main questions on, like, the progesterone thing and then the adrenal panels. That helps clarify things for me a little bit more.
Great.
You just know so much. Oh, my gosh.
Well, you know,
I can't wait to get to the point
time.
Where I
You'll
feel like I know more. Yeah.
In
well,
I'm
just
years,
working
no
with
worries.
Different people. Yeah, for sure. Well, I'm glad that, I mean, it felt good that you pointed that out, that as a new practitioner, I'm, like, noticing those things. It's like, oh, well, why is that so high?
Yeah.
I mean,
good.
I was really surprised.
It's good
yeah.
you're asking those questions, because that's what I'm – this course is as much as about information as the way that you – the way that your brain works. And we're going to talk a lot about that on Saturday when we first start out on the CMDS call, because I really want people to walk away with not like a this for that. Oh, we use this probiotic and this herb for that condition. No, this whole functional approach is all about thought process. And when you understand the underlying, you'll ask those questions. Whereas if you don't, you just go, oh, well, the TSH is high. Let me let me put them on Synthroid or that sort of band-aid-y approach. We don't want you to do that. I want you to be thinking. So even if you don't have all this stuff memorized, you can look things up. I still look things up. I'm surrounded by books. So somebody asked me something, something's just because it's over and over again, I remember ranges, but other things, I don't remember the exact right range. So you look it up, you know, but it's when you understand. I always tell people, I need to understand something first before I get it. And if I may forget the mechanism later and have to look it up again, but I know that it made sense and then I put it in my brain as this is valid. And so that's what I want for you. I want you to have a process, and the more we expose you to the biochemistry, the more we go into details about how this nutrient works or that. Are you going to remember all the names of all the folate receptors? You know, I'm reviewing that for presentation. I'm like, I don't remember this stuff, but I'm going to teach it anyway because I know to look it up. I don't remember this is named this and that's named that, but because that's not the important part. It's knowing, oh, when folate comes in, it has to do this and that and the other thing in the body, and then it got to convert there. Oh, and that requires a bunch of amino acids. I wonder which those amino acids were. I forget. Let me look those up. Oh, she's not converting from this to that, which means maybe she's deficient in, you know, these other nutrients. But you don't have to have them all committed to memory. I mean, it's just Jeffrey Bland has them all committed to memory. The guy's got a photographic memory. If you haven't listened to his talk in the ACR, go ahead and do that just for fun. You'll walk away with like a little fraction of what he had to say, and you'll have to watch it, listen to it five times before you get 50% of it. But he has all the stuff in his brain, and I'm in awe of him. But I'm not like that. You're not, the average person isn't like that. So we just have to know what our resources are, what our pathways are, what all the things are, and you're getting it. You're starting to get that what all these glands are, how they interact with each other, and it's just a process. And I wish I could speed it all up, and I wish I could download what's in my brain to one of those little USB sticks and just give everybody at the beginning of the program. But it doesn't work that way.
Right.
So
I wish it worked that way.
I wish it too, because there's stuff I want to learn more about. There's some Chinese medicine herbal things that I wish I had committed to memory, and I have to look up all the time because it's not something I use over and over. The more you use it, the better you get. You know, a few years back when I wasn't doing as many labs, I didn't have a lot of these ranges in my head, and now if somebody starts telling me stuff, I close my eyes and I can just see all the things happening.
That's how I do too. When I,
right?
If I study something a few times, it's see it in my head.
You'll get it. The same thing with fatty acids. People think I'm nutty because they'll start to talk to me about this, and I'm like, oh, but you can, and I'm pointing in the air as if there's some kind of chart there, and they're like, what are you pointing to? I'm like, oh, but this goes to that, and then this comes around, and I'm drawing circles, and because I see it, like the methylation pathways. It took me over and over and over again. Now I can see the swirls and I can see the different pieces. Not that I haven't memorized.
Now,
but
is there more than one? I'm kind of not very knowledgeable on the methylation pathways. Is there more than one methylation pathway? I mean, I know I had like the MT. I know there's one MTHFR. I was tested for that.
Yeah, we'll go into that. There's a whole. Come to the calls on like the vitamin B6, B12, and folate, and we have lots of pictures you can see. There, it's called the methylation cycle. It's called methylation, and there's a whole bunch of different pathways within there. And you know, this goes to that, and there's different overlapping circles. And
so that'll be within the program.
Oh,
the
yeah.
call that you're doing today on the B6s is that going to be more general information then?
I'll show those pathways for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll show. Okay. And the B6, if you haven't watched the B6 presentation, I showed it in there. The B12 presentation, I showed it in there because they're connected. So you'll see it over and over.
Okay.
Yeah. And then there's a whole 14 or 18 hours worth of videos up on the genomics thing already, and that's just on the consumer end. So. Yeah, lots to learn.
I just need more time to watch and to learn.
And you know what? What's going to guide you? What's going to guide you is you're going to get clients and they're going to ask you stuff and you're going to know some of it and some of it you're not. And then you're going to look to the resources. Then you're going to come to a call and I may say, oh, go watch this or listen to that.
Okay. Sounds great.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Very good questions. I'm going to go to the Q&A and then the chat. It looks like there's some activity happening on the chat. Okay. I think you had asked this question before, Sequoia. This is central vision loss due to malaria tablets. What would be good to give? B12 plus, previous information given by you was the B12, B12 age-related macular degeneration, 1,000 micrograms of B12 plus 2,500 micrograms of folate, 50 milligrams of vitamin B6, reduce the risk of developing loss of B12 deficiency. Yeah, so all of those things, What is the question? I mean, are you confirming that those were good suggestions? I mean, that was a study. You can also do vitamin C and A are very important. C is, as an antioxidant, was very protective. And, again, it depends on what's going on and what that mechanism was for that loss. But certainly I would look at those as a start since it reversed age-related macular degeneration. But A is important, and I would say C, but also the lutein, which is found in kale, astaxanthin, I can never say that word, but you know what I mean. That would be a good thing to look into as well. Jamie. There was a good webinar by Marion Owen for Genova that was recorded recently about nutritional status and hormone balance. She had some interesting insights about the differences she'd seen clinically between methylating 2-hydroxyestrogen, 4-hydroxyestrone, and the Dutch only measures 2-methoxy. I thought Dutch measured all of them, and that the 24-hour, there's one that the 24-hour urine is interesting. I don't remember which one. So anyway, there's a link. I'm going to put that link. Jamie, did you put that link in the chat? Are you on the other chat, the two-way chat? Okay, you are. If you could put that in there, because if I try to copy it, let me see if I can. I might be able to copy it. Yeah, I can. I'll just copy it and put it in the chat. So this is a good, I'll take a look at that. That sounds good. There we go. So I'm going to look to see what other questions here. Lynn looks like she's keeping up with it. Lynn said, I read that vitamin C improves oral absorption of thyroid hormone, levothyroxine, which is a synthetic, that's a T4, according to a study. Vanessa wants to know, what do you recommend for increasing focus and clarity for college students other than B vitamins, leafy greens, essential fatty acids, magnesium, essential oils? What are your thoughts on natural nootropics? Well, there's some suggestion about MCT oil being really good for the brain and clarity. It depends on what the problem is. If the person is got some serotonin or dopamine issues. The dopamine is really common for not having the focus, so you might look at some of that, but I would do that with, being careful, maybe doing an oat test to see. I know that, certain herbs like ginkgo can be really helpful for opening up the brain. You do have to be careful about people who tend to get headaches from it, like me. I already have too much circulation, I guess, to my brain. If I have ginkgo, it opens up. I would say looking at phospholipids would be good as well. So the phosphatidyl serine choline inositol, and you can look at things like lecithin, sunflower lecithin, or non-GMO organic soy lecithin can be helpful for that. I mean, there's a lot of things that are listed as nootropics. Some of them are better than others. One of my clients asked me to look at paracetam, and I didn't see anything really downside to it, but it really indicated that it didn't seem to be it didn't help if unless there was a real problem there. It doesn't just going to improve the brain function. I think some of the adaptogenic herbs can be really helpful as well. And it depends on what's going on. If the person is kind of gets stressed out, I would be looking at cortisol, and I'd also be looking at some of the calming herbs, believe it or not, that to help them get a deeper sleep so that then they're more focused during the day. And of course, drink more water. I think Vanessa hopefully knows that one already. Because dehydration is super important. And it's hard to talk to those college kids about sleep. My son was last week. Oh yeah, he said he had this big exam and he had to prepare 12 essays and they were going to choose three and he had been preparing for it. And it was like the day before I said, oh, so you're all ready to go. You're going to get a good night's sleep and do well. He goes, good night's sleep. He goes, I'm staying up all night. I'm like, oh, you know, that's not the best thing if you want to be focused on the exam. I mean, but that's what he did, and he seems to have done okay. But that's what college kids do. They just push themselves. They think that they are invincible. Jamie put up, Jamie did put up that. Thank you, Jamie. Jamie said, I just bought Alan Gaby's nutritional medicine book. It's truly a Bible. You know, I was debating whether to get it because I've done classes with Alan Gaby from back the time when he was, very young and first starting out with Jonathan Wright doing it back in the 80s. I've taken their class a couple of times and I have their thing and I was thinking, well, am I going to really learn more? But it's certainly worth it. The only reason I hesitated, because I never hesitate with books, but it's like a $200 book. But I really respect your opinion, so thank you. And Jamie agrees that Jeffrey Bland is amazing. Thank you for putting that up, Lynn. That's something I have looked at it, and he spoke at a conference I was at a couple of years ago, and he was talking about the book, and I looked at it, but I didn't buy it at the time. Oh, wait. If you join IFM Academy for $49, I thought IFM was a lot more than that. I thought I paid a couple hundred dollars to be in IFM. I'll go look on it. Great. Thank you. And Lynn just put up a link to Sunflower Lecithin. Yeah. Yeah, Vanessa, our kids are like around the same age, so I totally know. okay, let me refresh over here. Okay, so Dutch measures 4-hydroxy-E1, but not 4-methoxy-E1. So hydroxylation, not methylation, just, yes, that's true. And then the Meridian Valley does the 4-methoxy. And Jonathan Wright, when I heard him speak at a conference where the Dutch people were also speaking, was really clear to say, well, they don't measure the 4-methoxy. We do. The fours are the, you know, again, you know, you have to say, is it as important or what? At least they measure the 4-hydroxy, 4-OHE1, is the potent, really strong one that's very highly carcinogenic. And so you don't want somebody to have elevated levels of that. The 4-methoxy is a methylated form of that. You can argue that if you had just any one of the methoxies and you can compare it to the hydroxy, that you could see if they have a methylation issue. But methylation issues are identified in other ways as well. So, yeah, this is a science, but it's also an art, and you're still going to find differences in opinion similar to what we were talking about with Valerie early on about the thyroid. You know, the opinions just are all over the place because it's us mere mortals interpreting this amazing body, and we didn't come with the user's guide. So we don't have those Star Trek honing devices either, do we? Okay. Well, if you'd have a question, last chance to raise your hand, star 2. And if not, then I will take a break before my next call, which I usually don't get to do. And then we have another call after this for our VLM people and Before Be Gone people. And then later on we're doing, hopefully, finishing my presentation. My folate presentation is the last little bits to finish before we present that later this afternoon. So thank you, everybody, for being here and for participating. And I'll talk to you later soon, whenever. If not, have an awesome rest of the day, rest of the weekend. And just keep giving yourself the okay to not know everything and look it up, because we're constantly learning. I am constantly learning. And that's why I take so much time to put together all these presentations on the vitamins, minerals, because I always want to go back in and say, okay, what else? What else is new? What's the latest? How can I explain this in a way that you get it? So we'll never know it all. You'll never get it all done. And it's all good. It's all good. So I'll open up your lines. You could say goodbye, and we'll talk again soon. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.